retirement is not an age and it's not a number. When I get this old or when I reach $1 million and I'm going to retire and everything is going to be glorious. The problem with that is retirement is a completely different mindset. I basically approach this entire money, economics, finance subject entirely from scratch, but using the physicist mindset to figure out. The message here is that consumer society is 4 times more wasteful than it needs to be, and we work 4 times more than we need to.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question, what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. My guest today is Jacob Lundfisker. His book, Early Retirement Extreme, a philosophical and practical guide to financial independence, has been a big hit and remains a very popular read among those curious about frugal and responsible living while caring about the planet. It's so much more than that, though. His blog with the same name and the link in the notes is also a great resource. Jacob is a Danish-born astrophysicist living in the United States and enjoying an early retirement. He's very thoughtful and deliberate about how he lives his life. He took the time to sit down and discuss his research and findings with me. My prepared questions and our recording ended as planned, but we kept talking for another hour. Today, you'll hear about using physicists' mind and tools to figure out money, how working from home can effectively double your income, retirement is not an age or a number, peculiar challenges of retiring young, 2 definitions of freedom, frugal, responsible, and environmentally friendly living. And finally, how responsible living can lead us to early retirement. Please help me welcome Jacob Lundfisker. Hello, Jacob. Nice to see you.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Thank you for joining me today. And let's jump right in. We have a bunch of questions we want to get through today. We both grew up in Europe. I grew up in Poland, you grew up in Denmark. I almost studied at the same Danish university, Aarhus, as you did. You became an early retired astrophysicist, and I'm a lifelong stock investor. I'm curious how your upbringing and your childhood influenced your relationship with money.
I think it might be informative to see how just a few rare events changed everything. I mean, I'm not doing what other Danes are doing. Growing up in Danish culture, so I'm 47 now, this was the 80s and the 90s. Anything to do with money was left extremely open-ended because money was more or less a cultural taboo. It was not something people were talking about or not even thinking about because the Danish welfare state was already very well entrenched and had a good handle on everything. So the focus on accumulating money or getting rich was not really a thing anymore. And I think it has kind of become that way. But the message from parents, I'm talking very much in generalities, but definitely in my case, the message from parents and student counselors and career advisors and everybody was just to get an education, study whatever you're interested in, find a job that you're passionate about and just do whatever makes you happy. It doesn't really matter whether you get success was not really measured in terms of how wealthy or how rich you go. There's no such thing as like an American dream equivalent. The other thing was that most parents didn't really involve their kids in money matters. It was not something we talked about. I had basically no idea. Schools didn't teach it at all. In the 7th or 8th grade, there was a math exercise about making a budget, but it was not a budget that was relevant to personal finance at all. Career-wise, I would say the sum total of career guidance or counseling between grade 0 and leaving with my master's before I went to Switzerland, 20 hours tops, and that's very generous. Probably comes down to 1 or 2 career days and then an annual conversation with some history teacher they just brought in from the side to have a 10-minute conversation with each student about what are you interested in, right? Like civil engineering, or I want to be a fighter pilot, or I want to be a Lego designer. I was all over the map. I never really had an idea. The money framework or the takeaway from all this was just study whatever you're most interested in, and you find a job that you hopefully like, and then you spend it on whatever makes you happy. And if you ever need help with any of the details, you just go down to your friendly neighborhood banker and we'll set up a budget for you. So you don't even need to do that. The basic message is just become a happy working member of society. You know, you got to work. It doesn't really matter because everything will be taken care of. If you get employed, you know, the state will take care of you. So you don't need to know about money. That's a basic framework, a mindset I came out with as a graduate. Now what? I had no idea what like pension savings were, but I had heard some rumors about that it was important to start doing. So then I went to grad school in Switzerland, and of course, a completely different system. And having heard those rumors, I realized it was important. Being 24 years old, at that time, I basically approached this entire money, economics, finance subject entirely from scratch, but using the physicist mindset to figure it out. So formula and equations and diagrams, and to try to figure out what all this spending, saving and investing and working really meant. That's basically the backstory, starting from knowing nothing and figuring the system would have it well in hand, and then trying to make sense of it myself from scratch. And I turned into that.
Putting all the pieces together. I grew up in Cold War Poland, and I remember well the first decade of the economic transformation that followed. Consumer credit wasn't available. You bought what you could afford to buy. And once I moved to New York City, the American affinity for easy credit was a new experience to me. You have some thoughts on the topic. Can you elaborate? What are your thoughts on the use of credit by consumer today?
It's also like a similar situation. I think credit is extremely ingrained in U.S. culture, whereas I didn't even really know what it was. So there's the Saturday Night Live skit, a sketch called Don't Buy Stuff You Can't Afford. It's an American couple and then some salesman trying to sell this amazing plan called Don't Buy Stuff You Can't Afford. And it's a one-page book. And the funny thing is, of course, that this is like completely incomprehensible to the couple. Like, you don't, you mean you cannot spend it if you don't have it? Whereas on the reverse, right, the only conceivable concept for me and for you was basically, if you want to spend something, you got to earn it first.
Yeah.
And if you're not earning it fast enough, you got to save. So my attitude was always saving while thinking about what I'm going to buy for and then spend it. And then so my net worth looked like a zigzag curve that way. Even when I did this whole perspective, gaining an understanding of personal finance, having moved to Switzerland and first learned about what interest or what a mortgage was. Because again, in the Danish word for mortgage payment is husleje, which essentially is the same as rent. So I did not really even understand that there was a loan involved here, right? It's really like base level ignorance. It's as bad as it can get, right? And so when I did the calculation of what it would cost to buy a house, and I realized that the prevailing interest rates at the time, that was before the zero interest policy was, that it would cost something like 2 times the price of a house to buy the actual you'd pay for the house and then twice over in interest. And I was like, I'm never going to do that. That sounds outrageous. That's like borderline insane, right? So I basically made a commitment to save enough money while in grad school to purchase my first house in cash. And later I did. So to this day, I don't know what my credit score is. I've never bothered to look it up. I know it's important for insurance or something, but I'm not really doing anything actively to change it at all.
Yeah, that was a new concept to me, a credit score and the way it's calculated. So it's good if you borrow, just don't borrow too much and be a reliable payer. A little bit.
Yeah, exactly. When I moved over here, I got all this kind of like weird advice. You got to take a loan because having a loan is important so you can show that you can pay it off. Yeah, but if I can pay it off, if I can easily pay it off, why would I take it in the first place? It made no sense to me. But I think the thing is, like in the US structure of the cultural structure of behavioral control, if you will, that maybe sounds a little bit extreme when I put it like that, but structure that guides how people live is very much financially based, more so than in Europe, where the government is maybe 10% more controlling of people's lives. But it's very much about what in the book I described as a login, where essentially financial means is used to guide people's decisions. You got to get an education so you can earn money so you can live in this particular way. And it's all guided by these cash flows. And so there's this little running joke about financial innovation is essentially what you do to turn consumers into dependable cash flows. And there are various theories for that, like consumption maximization or consumption smoothing. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem, and technically it would work if people were super rational beings, but some will use it to live above their means. And sometimes like expectations that You take out a loan when you're young and you're not making that much, right? And then you'll pay it off later when you're earning more, but maybe earning more later. So this can fall apart. And of course, when I came to the US, I figured a way out by taking the other side of that deal.
Saving. I'm curious about your thoughts on remote work. In your book, Early Retirement Extreme, you talk about the benefits of working from home. And it's an idea much more common today than ever before. What are your thoughts? Has something changed or is it something that you saw coming?
It's been a long time since I wrote the book. Also a long time since I read it. But if you just talk like dollars, right, and compare, first of all, hey, it's not something I could really have predicted.
Right.
But starting every assumption from scratch, like, why do we pick this particular thing? It turns out a lot of times we pick it because that's just what you do. You never question what you actually need to do or what's the smartest operation here. So this whole thing about going into the office very much came about like as a path-dependent, organic thing in American history, right? Because the car was invented, energy was super cheap, and people figured one could build an economy out of moving the houses 10 miles out in this direction and moving the jobs that direction and then commuting back and forth, and it wouldn't be a big deal. It would be nice out there than in there. And so an entire economy has been built around that. Then came the end that it's a lot easier to work remotely. But cultural tradition resisted that for a long time. And it still does to some extent, but then the COVID lockdowns essentially forced the situation. And I think if you look at it, like just if you do the numbers, then if you calculate your actual effective wage, which is done in the book, Your Money or Your Life, I think is a very good way to think about it. So if you're going into the office, you have the same salary. Let's say it's the median salary of 40K a year. This is, I think, about a little over what most people make. But then you start deducting all the cost of working. So you spend like an hour a day commuting. If you have children, you need to look at daycare costs. You need office clothes, which can be like $50 a month or something. I looked up some of these numbers. People spend way more than I do. So I usually have to look up to see what the normal spending is. Then there's cafeteria food and various other things. And that is all after tax money. So that's the numerator of how much you make after all the costs of working are deducted. But then you also have to consider you had to spend the average time spent commuting in America is 1 hour per day, but it can go up to 3 hours. If you have children, you probably have to deliver them to some daycare center. So you can easily spend 10, 11 hours per day, even if you're only working 8, including also the mandatory lunch break. Or you can lose vacation hours because the toilet is broken. You need to call in the plumber, but the plumber say, oh, I'll be there anytime between 8 and 4. So you have to stay at home all day because the plumber's going to be there for 10 minutes to do that for you. So if you add all this together, which I did, it comes down to about $9 an hour, effectively, if you're making 40K a year. That's shocking to a lot of people.
It's hard to see that because it adds up quickly, both in terms of time and money, and eats away at your life. Yeah, very true.
And if you work from home, then a lot of these all go away. And so doing the same calculation, back of the envelope, you get pretty much twice as that, $18 an hour.
There you go.
And it's very hard for managers to basically having offered that situation to many people to claw that back again. No, now you got to go into the office. But I'm already used to my new effective salary being twice as high.
People enjoy that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I know some extroverts who actually miss the commute, if you can believe that. At least miss having all these team meetings and cooler conversations. But on the flip side of that, I think if you're leaning on the introverts side, I'm absolutely loving this work from home thing. As the commute is 5 minutes, you don't have all these silly team meetings and people are not constantly dropping in to have a chat.
Yeah, the quality of work improves.
Yeah, I think so.
And we'll see where it goes. But in your book, you mentioned it a long time before it became something common. You even call it telecommuting. And it's saying that today it's something that a lot of people tried, a lot of people tasted it, and we'll see where it goes. But I think it's hard to take it back once you tried it. The other question I had, our audience and our clients, they may find themselves already in a position of a full or almost full financial independence because of the wealth they inherited or acquired. What can they learn from you, an expert in early retirement extreme? What are the tips, advice that you would share?
Yeah, I think the primary thing, which is hard to accept, is that retirement is not an age and it's not a number. But that's the focus that a lot of people working have in mind. When I get this old or when I reach $1 million and I'm going to retire and everything is going to be glorious. The problem with that is retirement is a completely different mindset. You have to find new meaning, new purpose, new activities, and even a new aesthetic of how you look to the rest of the world. All this You have to figure out all this. If you're old enough and if you're rich enough, then the market can provide you with these solutions. If you're like senior citizen already, you can play bingo and nobody will bet an eyebrow. There's cruise ships, so you can do flow painting at the senior center. There's all these solutions you can take. But if you're much younger than that, then you can't really do those. I guess you can try, but I don't know anyone put out to the senior center at age 35 and ask, can I play along? I think, so there's basically no market for it. You have to figure it out for yourself. I think the second problem for people who reach financial independence at a young age is that they have typically been very future oriented, very dedicated, the typical overachiever, and they haven't done any real recreation since, I don't know, they were 15 or something. They might never have had a vacation. I know that was my case back then. You know, just basically no sabbatical year or anything, straight to university from high school. Basically no time period in their life where they had nothing coming up. And so they're very deficient on the whole recreation aspect. Yeah. But on the flip side of that, you can't spend your entire life on recreation. That becomes really hard. And that's the default of the young overachievers. So I'm so exhausted. And now that I'm financially independent, I'm going to travel because I always want to travel. So I'm going to go to Europe and spend a year there and see what happens. So they go to Europe and spend a year to see what happens. And then nothing really happens and they come back again. And now what? I did get an office job and I'm heading back to that is the majority of cases. So I would say it's very hard to spend a lot on recreational activities. It does happen, but it's difficult.
It's basically looking for purpose beyond earning a paycheck.
Yeah. That's like philosophically, there's two different definitions of freedom, a so-called positive freedom and negative freedom. Mm. They're also called freedom to do something. That's the positive side. And then there's the freedom from something, that's negative freedom. And as financial independence became more mainstream and more well-known, the focus shifted from the freedom to or the positive freedom to the negative freedom. It's like, I hate my job. I want to be financially independent. Whereas originally it was more on the positive freedom. For financial independence for me is just the starting line so I can go do something else that I cannot do as a job because there's simply no, it's not part of what I want to do with my life. It's not part of the market economy. So yeah, it's now turned to, I just want out, but yeah, out into what?
Exactly. Looking for a new purpose. As consumers and investors, we're all becoming more aware of the environmental impact of mostly the consumer culture that we see. You discuss our finite planet extensively in your book, a limited amount of resources that we have. What advice would you have for a consumer and an investor who wants to do their part? Where do we start?
Yeah, I basically went extreme with it. And I guess part of my mission is that people are not merely taking this seriously enough. Eerie early retirement extreme essentially started by being hyper-aware of the situation we're in and then doing this to see what it would take for someone to be truly sustainable, not just buy sustainable products, but really live within my footprint. There's this concept called the ecological footprint. And you've probably heard of this idea that if everybody lived like Americans, we need four more planets. Or at this point, it's usually in July or June that we've run out of all our sustainable allotment of resources for the year. And of course, we don't have four planets to draw resources on. The point with that is that humans as such are drawing down the capital of the planet. We're not just living off the interest. We're having a natural resource bank account that is drawing down. And so when I was in grad school, like I calculated based on these ideas of the ecological footprint, how much I could spend per year if everybody were to live in the same way I live. So if everybody got every human on the planet got the same amount, how much could I maximally spend in all this field? Fully sustainable, that is one planet, not four of making resources waste all the way to at least December 31st. And that turned out to be about $6,000 per person per year. And you can read on the calculation from time to time, and it's always between $6,000 and $7,000. So no adjusting for inflation, this is the actual number each year. And so inflation is basically canceled out by the decent how much we can carry plus the increase in population. And that turns out to be about half the US poverty line, but it's also the same as a student stipend I had as an undergraduate. So technically I already knew it was possible, but on the flip side, I didn't want to keep living like an undergraduate student. I was 2000 when I did this calculation. I decided, what can I do as a personal experiment to see if it is actually possible to live as an ex-student, as an adult human being in this world would it be possible to live an interesting life on that amount? And the strategy to do that was essentially to learn a bunch of skills that all my grandparents' generation and older already knew. And that way become more self-reliant and then decouple myself from the economy as whole. Mm-hmm. And the side effect of that was that, yeah, you can do it. And if I, as a postdoc, I was living around 40K, right? And as a grad student, about 25K. And if you only spend six of those, right, your savings rate becomes enormous, 75% easy. And that led to financial independence in 5 years. And it turned out that people were way more interested in that than they were about saving the planet. So I basically led with that instead, even though it's the same principle.
If we can do both at the same time, I think it's a win-win all around. Exactly. Just tell me, at 7,000, is it sustainable in the sense that we are just living off the interest, so to speak?
Yeah, that's exactly at the level. So that's what the interest is.
The planet produces a certain amount of resources. We use just that. We're not taking more than the annual replenishment of the planet, the 7,000. That's something to think about, I think. For all of us.
And I think with the financial independence, that's like the carrot argument. Mm-hmm. Then if we live in this new way, we learn these skills and become way more efficient with how we use our resources and our money. We actually don't need to work that much.
No.
The meta message here is that consumer society is four times more wasteful than it needs to be. And we work four times more than we need to as well. But the most sustainable argument is something you can save 10% if you upgrade your furnace or you put solar panels in. But that's not going to be enough. You need 400%.
You need more. Mm-hmm. You need more than that. You mentioned previous generations. And I'm thinking of my grandparents. They walked a lot. My late grandfather walked everywhere, I remember. And I spend most of my adult life in Manhattan, so I walk daily. I still do. And you're a big fan of walking, riding a bicycle, but not cars. And what's your philosophy?
I mean, I would say maybe it's more like I'm a big fan of deliberate choice.
Uh-huh.
So like when you live in Manhattan, it makes a lot more sense to walk than to drive. Mm-hmm. I had the distinct displeasure of going through New York by car. And what I know, there was complete traffic jam. And I noticed, this is the same guy who just walked past us like 20 minutes ago. And the car is going, and he's just catching up with us every block. And
it's there is a lesson, insane, right? There's a lesson there.
Yeah, absolutely. I looked up what the average speed of a US driver is. It's 18 miles an hour. That's the average speed of a car. So just that's what like a fit person can do on a bicycle.
I think in cities, it would be half of that. If you took the LA, New York, Chicago.
Yeah, it's much lower. So then this is why it makes no sense to have a car in the city. Or drive a car in the city. And I guess the city is like figuring this out with what is it called? Congestion pricing and all that, where they want people to park the car out in the burbs and take the train in. But the key problem is that it's not just cars, it's also housing and food and everything else, basically. It's a consumer product and we just buy it because we think that's the only way. But there's in general like a whole range of options. If we pick the wrong one, it's not a very efficient use of money. The bicycle is much cheaper than a car. And if you can go at a general maximum speed in your car, 12 miles an hour, you should probably ride a bicycle, right? But on the other hand, I've also seen this bicycle or cycling religion go a little overboard. I commend it for health reasons. That's the other thing. That's different side effects. Driving a car is generally unhealthy. On the other hand, cycling can be dangerous. But I've seen people where they commute in 50 kilometers. That's pretty hardcore. If you live out in the sticks, maybe that car makes sense. So it's that choice.
Health. And money and the benefit for the planet.
Yeah. Henry David Thoreau, he mentioned back then people would go to work and they save up to buy a horse so they could travel there faster. And his point was that, well, if you just started walking now, you'll probably arrive sooner than if you followed this, I must buy my solution strategy.
I wrote an article about the 30-minute commute, and I looked up all kinds of research that we've had 30-minute commute for centuries, all the way back to Roman times. People tried to live 30 minutes away from work, but they walked, then they took a horse, then a carriage, then a car. So the distance has expanded, and they show the cities, how Paris grew over time, for example. But the 30 minutes is a constant throughout time, which is remarkable.
Right. It is, yeah. I didn't know that.
A lot of us had to, at some point, probably travel more, and very few could travel less. But for a lot of people, it was always the 30 minutes, just remarkable. And remote work, or you call it telecommuting in your book, has changed the paradigm here, because it could be 30 seconds between your bedroom
and
your kitchen or terrace or in a work from. I think it's something new to our civilization.
but also from the perspective of work, it means that companies can recruit from a much larger area. They can technically be global in that regard. I remember previously I was in Kansas City and I was living in California, and I was told, your resume is really great. We'd bring you in if you live here, but since you don't, we won't. We'll pay for the plane ticket. Remote work was not a thing back then.
It opens up a world of opportunities, both for businesses and people. There's a theory that to grow the economy, we may as well pay people to dig a hole and then pay the others to cover it. And it's a real theory.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that we have companies selling unhealthy food or products and other companies selling drugs to address the illness. We seem to be stuck in a hole here. So how do we dig ourselves out of it? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's Keynes, right?
Yes.
So the fun thing about Keynes is that he also wrote a letter that I like to wave around whenever this comes up called The Economic Possibilities of Our Grandchildren.
Uh-huh.
He wrote that in 1930.
Uh-huh.
The letter, if I remember correctly, goes up to 2020 or 2010 or something. And his prediction was that if productivity kept growing as it was, you know, standard trajectory, then we'd only be working a couple of hours to the in 2020. He was right about one thing and wrong about the other thing, his prediction of how much productivity would grow about a factor of four, but he was wrong about how we'd spend it. When TV was invented, all the idealists and nerds thought, well, we're going to use this to educate the entire population, free education for everybody, and it turned into operas and sitcoms, right? With productivity, exactly the same. It is essentially a very intricate way of wasting resources while looking good doing it. This was part of my strategy. I was essentially not wasting 75% of my money on living. We should make deliberate choices.
You write about tightly coupled systems and you argue in favor of Slack. I wrote a whole article about the need for Slack in life and investing, and it can mean different things. Can you elaborate on the thinking behind the tightly coupled systems and why they have challenges and why we need some Slack in life? I thought this was a fascinating idea that very few people embrace these days.
What's behind it is essentially systems thinking, which is still unusual. When we go to school, it's essentially compartmentalization. We have all these boxes we put things in.
Right.
And so coupling essentially relates to how much, if you change one box, how much that affects another box in the entire system.
Mm-hmm.
There are different kinds of coupling, strong and weak coupling. It's the general idea. Even more intricately, I could attach multiple boxes together instead of this kind of like box A, box B, box C, box D. That normally an advanced method to think about compartmentalization is to like, we just got to optimize each box separately.
See.
Systems thinking is, no, we should not do that. We should look at how all the boxes work together if we unbox everything. There's a lot of efficiency to be captured there.
To keep it flexible. I like
that.
You are very thoughtful, pragmatic, and you mentioned deliberate in how you choose to live your life. I wonder, what's your definition of success?
I try to avoid defining it because, I mean, there's something called Goodhart's Law. If you define a measure for success, that measure will fail on you.
Uh-huh.
And the reason is that people will start gaming it in education, right? You decide, okay, what's a success? You define a test and success is your GPA. The unintended consequence of that is that people, the students and teachers begin to strive not for education, but to simply get good test scores. When we're trying to develop some of these ERE concepts, because ERE is so extreme, it's so far outside of consumer thinking. If you heard the 7,000, well, that's half the poverty, right? So probably lives in a cardboard box and eats soup or something. So there are like stages on how to have a conversation with people depending on how much they do.
Right.
Kind of goes back, what do you do in retirement? Well, my mission was not to be bored.
You don't come across somebody that could be bored. Your book could be 12 books in one because you touch on so many topics from economics to physics and math and understanding life and philosophy and climate and personal finance in many ways. We still have so much to learn and so much to discover, but I think we touched on so much today, and your book is a real resource. I learned a lot from it. It gave me some inspiration. And as you said, there are many problems. And it's hard to pick one to start with, but we have to start somewhere, right? Yep.
My best recommendation for anyone who wants to start somewhere is to do the Buy Nothing Year Challenge.
Buy nothing year. It definitely changes the way we think about consumption in our life. Jacob, thank you so much. This was wonderful. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Seekard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Seekard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents, available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.